it's pretty ridiculous, just for, like, from a common sense perspective, that you think that this guy who is a billionaire and is like running two multi-billion dollar tech companies simultaneously also happened to have enough free time to be thinking about like reinventing the monetary system from scratch.
This episode of Supply Shock is powered by Core. You'll hear more about them later in this episode. For now, let's dive in. Crypto's premier institutional conference is coming to New York City, March 18th to the 20th. That's right, I'm talking about Digital Asset Summit, presented by Blockworks. Of course, I'll be there bringing a Bitcoin maximalist perspective to a number of talks and panels, where I'll be discussing why Bitcoin might be headed to $1 million. And, well, the rest of the digital asset market just might be trending to zero. Get your tickets online today. They're selling fast. He invented Twitter, Square, and revolutionized social media and point-of-sale payments, but is Jack Dorsey, Satoshi Nakamoto. Welcome to Supply Shock. I'm your host, P. Rizzo, the Bitcoin historian. Our guest here today is none other than co-founder of Casa, a Bitcoin legend, who found Bitcoin when it was trading under $10 in 2012, tweeted about the first halving and fought in the block size wars I'm talking about. Jameson Lopp, who joins us today among those accolades. He's also a rigorous researcher who's known for disproving popular theories about Satoshi, writing about why Craig Wright was not Satoshi in 2019, and then last year, debunking the longstanding myth that Hal Finney, the famous cryptographer, was Satoshi Nakamoto. Welcome to the program, Jameson.
Good to be here. And I'm also told that I share a bit of a likeness with Dorsey himself now that he's sporting my same beard style.
Yes, matching beards. Well, let's dive into it. The theory that Jack Dorsey is Satoshi Nakamoto, obviously, to people who have been around for a long time in Bitcoin, this was a laughable theory. You know, we laughed and guffawed, but maybe a bit stickier than we thought. Do you want to kind of go into like what the pretext is and really like kind of the post that kicked off this exploration of yours and some of these details?
The short version is that they kind of hooked into the fact that, you know, Jack was an OG cypherpunk. He was on the mailing list. He was studying computer science when he was at university and was doing things like, I think, wearing the Adam Back cryptography export T-shirt. Really, when they started trying to go down the rabbit hole and, you know, get more details and things that would make it seem like he was actually Satoshi, that's when it kind of went off the rails and they were talking about all of this numerology stuff and really just like trying to find patterns of characters and transaction hashes and addresses and timestamps that things happen. So, you know, my general take is like when you're starting to stretch into the numerology sphere, that's when you're really reaching, because you're basically, you're trying to find meaning amongst a bunch of randomness. And when you're trying to do that, if there's a large enough data set, you're probably going to find things that seem meaningful.
Yeah, I'll pull a few of the ones that I thought, you know, and this, again, this is the, I think one of the advantages here were just the length of this Twitter post. You know, people got excited about the idea. They were probably sharing it. But when you kind of look in the details, I'll read some of the more ridiculous ones. Satoshi joined the Bitcoin forum on Jack's birthday. Coincidence, but doesn't prove anything. Satoshi's last mined block was on Jack's dad's birthday. And again, don't know if that's true. Sounds convincing. And then let's see. Satoshi told Hal in an email about an address that began with NS. You know, not super convincing. Jack sends Bitcoin to four addresses after Hal, including one that has JD2M in the middle. So, yeah, I mean, again, I think a lot of fluff in this. Why do you think that people were, found an appeal in this, I guess, maybe before we got with the debunk in? Like, what the people were in the Bitcoin space? Like, why do we maybe want Jack to be Satoshi? Like,
yeah, I mean, there are some people who always enjoy kind of having a hero figure. And then, you know, this is, of course, the long-standing greatest unsolved mystery of Bitcoin, who actually created Bitcoin. So if someone actually did successfully prove the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto, you know, that would give them a decent amount of street cred in some circles. Of course, I would say in general, those of us who consider ourselves cypherpunks take the perspective that Satoshi valued their privacy. They did not want to be identified. And beyond that, it's downright dangerous, you know, both to Satoshi, potentially to Satoshi's family. And it's not great for the Bitcoin ecosystem in general, because I think it's just better for the creator to be this mythological figure that only has it's like 900 or so data points, like posts and related things that they said in that 2-year period, versus being a known human who is probably going to have said things or done controversial stuff that people will try to use against them and try to use as a sort of slight against Bitcoin itself.
Well, maybe take us into like how you approach the debunking. So, you know, this got on your radar, blew up a couple weeks ago, you know, the theory Jack is Satoshi, people tweeting about it. How did you kind of mentally then go, you know, okay, or how do you start your research process? Is there any sort of kind of things that you go to now that you've done this a few times, or you had tried and true tricks, or what did you think about?
I mean, it's difficult to prove a negative, regardless of what you're trying to do. So we're trying to prove that someone is not Satoshi. How do you actually comprehensively do that? And I think the best thing that you can really aspire to is to prove that someone was out and about and doing things where they were not at a keyboard, you know, not writing code, not commenting on Bitcoin Talk, whatever. And that's essentially what I did with Hal Finney. Is I was lucky enough to come across a race that he participated in, which happened to conflict with several activities where Satoshi was sending emails and sending Bitcoin transactions. And basically, like, we had hard timestamp evidence both of Satoshi doing things and of Hal Finney doing things, where it couldn't possibly be the same person doing both of those things at the same time. So I basically tried to apply that same methodology here. And it's actually pretty funny, because Jack Dorsey is probably the worst candidate that you could point at to make the claim that they're Satoshi, because of how public Jack Dorsey was. Like, Jack Dorsey was probably the most avid tweeter back in 2009 and 2010. I counted up 6,200 tweets in that 2-year period, which is like 8.5 tweets per day. So he was tweeting on almost an hourly basis, you know, if you average it out. And so that is just a really nice data set to work with to try to find conflicts with the like 950 or so timestamped activities that we have of Satoshi doing various things.
All right, so you had this data from Hal. You were able to look at the races, prove that he couldn't have been behind the keyboard and racing at the same time. Obviously, you know, impossible to do. So was there a smoking gun here with Jack? You know, you're talking about these tweets. Obviously, you know, you could probably tweet on Twitter and be writing on Bitcoin Talk. Was he in a conference? Is there a smoking gun here that is driving this conclusion that he's not Satoshi?
So I found a dozen or so conflicting events, and none of these are quite as strong as the Hal, you know, running a race thing where, like, you know, he's not on a phone or anything else. However, I think in aggregate, like, the likelihood that all of these things were somehow, you know, set up ahead of time and manipulated by Jack, it makes it highly unlikely. So at a very, very high level of, like, looking at the aggregate of just their timestamp activity in general, the first thing that really pops out at you, if you chart the hours of the day when Satoshi was doing stuff and when Jack was doing stuff, you can see very clearly that they're not following the same pattern. And I'm sure we can put the chart up here for people to look at. But essentially, Satoshi followed a very rigorous schedule that it tends to follow what you would expect from someone who is living in the Pacific time zone. You know, their sleep schedule was very consistent over that 2-year period. And by sleep schedule, I just mean the times that they were not posting, where you would assume that that was because they were asleep. Jack, on the other hand, is very well known because there are many tweets where he talks about this. He was bi-coastal. And the reason for that is very simple. He was running two big companies. He was running both Twitter, which is based in San Francisco, and he was getting Square up and off the ground, and Square was in New York City. So he was regularly going back and forth between New York City and San Francisco. And so when you actually look at the chart of Jack Dorsey's tweets, it is not a consistent sleep schedule. And this makes sense because he was bi-coastal. He was going back and forth between time zones that are 3 hours apart. So that's just like the first very high level thing. Of course, this isn't conclusive in and of itself, but it just shows that from a like high level persona and, you know, public timestamp perspective, they were not following similar schedules. Now, beyond that, like digging into specifics, there were a dozen or so specific events where Jack was tweeting about things that he was doing. These have, I would say, different levels of certainty behind them. You know, some of these were, oh, I'm having lunch with someone, or I'm out shopping with my friends, or I'm at an event like he liked to go to baseball games a lot. And so, you know, those I would say would be like lower on the certainty schedule, because sure, like maybe he could have somehow slipped in a forum post or something, you know, while he was doing these more casual things. But there's a few events where I would say it's highly unlikely that Jack would have been writing code or posting stuff. And some of those are events where he was meeting with essentially government figures. So there was one event where he was meeting with the mayor of Paris. There was one event where he was meeting with Cory Booker, who was the mayor of Newark, New Jersey at the time.
I also saw Alyssa Milano, the famous activist there.
Yeah. And let's see, there was also one event where he met with the president of Chile. And I did find a photo of that event. And those like those public figure events are very well time boxed because generally you can see a tweet directly before and directly after the meeting when that occurs. So we know, you know, with a high degree of certainty exactly when the meeting happened. And then there's just a number of other events where he was giving presentations at Square or demoing Square in public. Like there was one time he was at the Chicago Apple Store for several hours giving demos at the same time that Satoshi was posting on Bitcoin Talk. So, you know, it's things like that where you know that, you know, he was doing an event in public in which he was highly engaged in whatever that event was and was probably not able to like be on his phone or computer doing other things, whatever Satoshi was doing at that time.
Hodling isn't enough anymore. Bitcoin is evolving on Core, unlocking yield, utility, and a thriving DeFi ecosystem. With over 250 dApps and nearly $1 billion in total value locked, Bitcoin DeFi is growing fast. Hundreds of thousands of users are already staking, lending, and building on Core's high-speed, low-fee rails. Now it's your turn. Whether you're a user or a builder, the Core Ignition program rewards you for participating in Bitcoin's next evolution. Unlock your Bitcoin and use Core. Start earning with Ignition today at ignition.coredao.org/blockworks. For the past decade, Ledger has been the global leader in digital asset security, trusted to secure more than 20% of the world's crypto assets. Celebrating 10 years of innovation, Ledger is making digital ownership more secure and accessible with their latest products, Ledger Stacks and Ledger Flex. These wallets feature the world's first secure touchscreens, simplifying your digital transactions while ensuring uncompromising security through Ledger's secure chip and proprietary OS. Plus, with the Ledger Security Key app, you can say goodbye to traditional passwords and step up your digital protection. Ready to protect your assets? Choose the most trusted name in hardware wallets, Ledger, and take control of your digital security today at ledger.com. Unlock the power of your Bitcoin with Ledin. For over 6 years, Ledin has helped thousands hodl their Bitcoin while accessing liquidity, focusing on transparency, security, and trust. Learn what your Bitcoin can do for you and see why so many clients trust Ledin. Visit ledin.io to learn more.
I mean, is it possible? So it sounds like maybe these were, let's just say, like, put our conspiracy theory hats on, these were fake events. Like, maybe there were, you know, there's a motive or intent to hide this activity here. You don't think that that's the case here?
I mean, it's always possible. You can say, okay, maybe these things were scripted and published ahead of time. But I think the likelihood of these events in particular, like being set up as some sort of misdirection, is pretty unlikely. It's, you know, it all follows Jack's persona, his modus operandi. There are many, many, many other events that I came across where, you know, it was within an hour or so, but there wasn't a perfect conflict and contradiction. And this is all just because Jack is such a public person. And I would say, like, even beyond the, you know, finding specific conflicts of stuff, it's pretty ridiculous just for, like, from a common sense perspective, that you think that this guy who is a billionaire and is, like, running two multi-billion dollar tech companies simultaneously also happened to have enough free time to be thinking about, like, reinventing the monetary system from scratch. It's I guess, you know, it's technically possible.
Well, we know with Elon, I mean, how many companies is Elon running now? And he's got 18 kids and three different wives. So, you know, maybe this is just a sign of the times that people think Jack is sort of one of these figures. So you're saying no smoking gun here, but it sounds like you're saying that just the strongest evidence here is really just someone couldn't have been, you know, doing the detailed kind of level of work that Satoshi was doing, and then also running these companies. Maybe you can speak a bit more, like, why do you believe that? And, like, what was so difficult about what was Satoshi was doing that, like, it's unlikely that maybe even on the same day Satoshi would have done something else as opposed to one of these, you know, kind of coding events that he was working on?
Well, yeah, so, you know, there were a few of the Bitcoin Talk posts were essentially him doing a deep level of code testing and basically doing tech support for people, like, with the Bitcoin code at the time. And so, like, a few of these Bitcoin Talk posts, he's not just, you know, posting a few sentences and replying to someone. He's also uploading code. He's making code changes and saying, yes, I figured out, like, what this bug was. So, like, he was debugging some issue, which would have meant that, like, you'd have to have, like, a full laptop with a development environment stuff. Like, this is not stuff you can just do on your iPhone. So, like, the likelihood that you know, Jack could have been going around just with his iPhone and doing all of this stuff is just not something, you know, myself as a computer scientist, like, we don't do that type of stuff on phones. The environments just aren't set up for it.
Yeah, I've looked at the Satoshi posts on Bitcoin Talk, and I would agree, right? A lot of the users were coming to him. He was very involved in Bitcoin in the early days. So I'm assuming some of these events you're talking about, people lost Bitcoin. They're asking him what happened. They're saying that they couldn't load a wallet. And, you know, these are things that he had to take very seriously because the project was very new and the perception of the project was very important. And he was essentially kind of the lead developer and, you know, lead maintainer and really the only person that these users can go to. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and just sort of what Satoshi's kind of goal and just maybe how much time he would have been putting into the project in those early stages.
Yeah, I mean, this is mostly like other early adopters trying to run or build or modify or write their own code to interact with their Bitcoin nodes. This is fairly in-depth technical stuff, you know, dealing with, you know, platform-specific C++ compilation and library issues and stuff like that. It's not just like a FAQ, how do you use the Bitcoin RPC API type of stuff. So, you know, this is, of course, in the very early days where, you know, the Bitcoin, it wasn't even Bitcoin Core back then. It was just Bitcoin. It was the only software in existence. And so anyone who wanted to do anything with Bitcoin had to be able to, you know, get that full node and wallet software up and running and doing what they needed.
Yeah, I'm just reading through some of these, you know, claims that the kind of accuser here, I guess, is making about Jack. And I'm also just struck by, you know, there seems to be this assertion that because Jack loves Bitcoin and because he speaks about it so passionately and so well, that this is sort of a grounds for accusing him to be Satoshi. So I'll read one of my favorite, you know, proof points that he's Satoshi on. October 27, 23, Jack said at a conference, Bitcoin and Satoshi in 2009 was a combination of my childhood and my curiosity and everything that I aspired to be and everything that I loved. So what do you think, I guess, of this connection where just because Jack loves Bitcoin so much, he's a plausible candidate for Satoshi, because I imagine someone could probably find things that you said that are pretty similar to that, and that there's nothing Satoshi specific about that quote.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, Bitcoin was the result of goals that many cypherpunks had been trying to achieve for decades. So, you know, one of the major claims was he was an OG cypherpunk, and there were like 1,300 people on that original list. And I would say, sure, being on that list makes you a higher priority candidate for being Satoshi. But there's also no reason why Satoshi had to have been on that list. It's entirely possible for someone to have, you know, stumbled upon this idea of wanting to create a new type of digital currency, and, you know, figuring out just a completely different way of doing it. I mean, if you think about it, everybody who had been on the cypherpunks list had failed to come up with a solution anywhere near what Satoshi had done. Like, no one had come up with this idea of using a blockchain data structure. Nobody had come up with the idea of using a global proof of work mechanism that adjusts itself. It's entirely possible that Satoshi came in completely out of left field, and because they had not been indoctrinated to a lot of the ways that the cypherpunks had done things, that's what allowed them to think differently about it.
Yeah, there's one thing about this Satoshi research is that there's a lot of conflicting evidence, right? So I'll give a couple examples. You know, the newer emails that we got last year from the Craig Wright trial, from Marty Malmy and Adam Back, you know, there was kind of this consensus that, like, Satoshi was younger, right? He was using colloquial words that maybe younger people would use. But that almost sort of conflicts with, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, you know, there was the popular theory that, you know, Satoshi used double spacing, and this is, you know, somebody who used a typewriter, you know, would have used this, or that his style was sort of academic. So, you know, I do think this thread sort of plays around with some of the, like, open conflicting, you know, pieces of evidence. So maybe let's just go with that age one. You know, is it because now, you know, we think Satoshi might be younger? Is that what makes Jack sort of, like, it gets him pulled into these sort of conspiracy threads? And maybe where do you fall on that? Was there anything that, or do you, on that spectrum, in terms of, like, what you think his age might have been?
I think people like to look at Jack for the same reason that some people have floated the idea that Elon Musk could be Satoshi. It's like, somebody just wants Satoshi to be, like, one of the richest and most powerful people in the world.
For some reason, he is, right? Reagan's by the value of the Bitcoin, right? Assuming that they still have the, you know, a million or so, they say. But yeah, I think that the thread is an interesting bit of fan fiction, you know, in terms of just, you know, what it says more about what people want to be, you know, to be Satoshi. I think, you know, I'll just read another one of my favorite kind of claims here. Lex Friedman asked Jack if he was Satoshi, and Jack told him that he wouldn't admit it if he was. And the author here is saying this contrasts with Nick Szabo, Adam Back, and Hal Finney, who said they were explicitly not Satoshi. So is Jack's refusal to admit that refusal to renounce his Satoshi-ness make him a candidate, in your view?
Well, that was that one interview. There was actually a different interview where he said, no, 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 no. So, you know, once again, I think this is cherry picking. And, you know, there's probably several aspects of the persona that I have not really dug into very much. But, like, one thing that really just came to mind that I hadn't thought about is, and I learned this while I was doing the research, Jack Dorsey actually went on multiple different tours of countries as a part of the United States State Department. So he did a tour of Russia, he did a tour of Iraq, and maybe one or two other places. And so I think, just related to, like, what we know of Satoshi and Satoshi not really being a fan of big centralized authorities, it's, once again, it would be very odd for Satoshi to be dealing so closely with the federal government and going on trips and doing things as a part of that.
Do you think this is testament to really just, like, the public perception of Jack as well, right? Because he's changed over the years, right? Ever since he left Twitter. You know, you see the pictures of him with the beard, as you mentioned, your beard comparison, like, in Africa doing Bitcoin things. And there's this kind of rise in viewing Jack as this kind of eccentric guy, you know, just because of what he's doing with Bitcoin and the level that he's supporting it. Because we also know that, you know, in some ways, if Jack wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, he's very important in the project today. He's funding, you know, probably over 20 to 30% of development, you know, according to different research papers. So, you know, maybe in some ways, you know, he's sort of earned this accolade or earned the accusation. I guess, what do you make of that?
You know, I think a lot of the people who are accused of being Satoshi candidates are Bitcoin legends in their own right. Like, they don't have to be Satoshi. They have contributed in a variety of different ways to being, being Satoshi in the way that we are all Satoshi, right? It's like anyone who contributes to Satoshi is essentially building upon the legacy where Satoshi, you know, left the project open to the world so that anyone who cared could contribute to it.
So the post title, Jack Dorsey is not Satoshi Nakamoto. Do you think you're 100% definitive? Do you think you've proved this to the level that you got with Hal Finney, and that the marketplace is going to be satisfied with your announcement here?
I think it's pretty close. It's also possible that, you know, once I put this out, that, you know, some of those events, perhaps people who are involved in those events have their own photos or videos or other information that would kind of help corroborate. And one of the really tricky things in what I was doing was going back and trying to find preferably video evidence. And it can be very difficult to go and find stuff that is like 15 plus years old at this point.
Yeah, that's one of the quirks of the internet, right? I think we don't have that much data from like the 08 to 12 era. So even someone as public as Jack, his internet footprint from that era, even though, you know, by the evidence that you put together, it seems like by today's standards, it would be pretty voluminous, right? If he's meeting with Alessa Mulatto, he's meeting with, you know, the Chilean government, we would have a lot of videos, photos, but, you know, it seems like with these older events, is that just a link rot? That's just how we're going to have to make sense of this time period.
So for example, like a number of the posts, the tweets that I cite from Jack actually had photos, but that photo service YFrog no longer exists. So those photos just show up as broken links now. You know, I was also trying to find any sort of press interviews, and he did a ton of press interviews. And one of the biggest problems that I ran into is like, I would find times when he was on television or had various video interviews, and I could see that it was on the same date that Satoshi was doing stuff, but I could not dial in the granularity to an hour time period that would be sufficiently good enough to show that it truly was a conflicting activity.
So you're 99% sure then, I guess, or what percentage would you say you're certain that Jack is not Satoshi at this point?
Yeah, at least 99%. I think it would really require some superhuman level of effort and coordination in order to do all of this and you know, keep Satoshi's persona and activity under the radar. And you know, have a lot of these events basically like pre-programmed to fire off ahead of time, while Jack himself was basically trotting around the globe. And as I mentioned in my article, he doesn't even like using like a full-fledged laptop. I'm pretty sure that as soon as Apple became a thing, he went full iPhone, iPad, and has basically stuck to that ever since. Because I recall actually having a conversation with him personally a few years ago where he mentioned that he doesn't even use laptops.
Well, I want to talk about the, you know, history of debunkings, as you brought up. You know, Peter Todd accused of being Satoshi just last year and you know, has dealt with some of the physical threats or the accusations of just the media craze. So far, it seems like with Jack Dorsey, you know, the media pickup on this theory has been, you know, I would say somewhat substantial. You know, with Peter, it seems like, you know, things have died down. Maybe that frenzy. Do you think we're moving out of the era where being labeled a Satoshi candidate is a serious physical threat or threat to your Bitcoin? From a, you know, perspective of Casa, you're thinking about long-term holdings, you know, so is it as so many people have been accused of being Satoshi that it doesn't matter anymore? Or do you think that it still matters from a personal security perspective?
I think it mostly just depends upon the strength of the evidence that is provided. And so, you know, all of the Satoshi claims so far have been based upon highly circumstantial evidence. And so, you know, since it's circumstantial, it's like, yeah, it's possible this person could be, but it's by no means incontrovertible. And so, you know, something that I've said for a long time, like with regard to Craig Wright, is that like, the reason that you know that people don't really believe Craig Wright is Satoshi is that nobody has tried to wrench attack him. And I would say like the same thing with, you know, these other people who've been accused of being Satoshi. Like if the evidence was sufficiently strong, then I believe that they would be getting attacked. But because it's much more hand wavy and it's just like, well, they could be, but there's also 1,000, if not several thousand other potential candidates who fit the same bill, it's not worth someone, you know, risking their own body and performing criminal activities on this very tiny sliver of a chance.
Well, I want to talk about that threat vector, because we've seen some just crazy stories this year. Of course, the big one that went mainstream was the Ledger co-founder who was kidnapped, him and his wife, even disfigured. He lost one of his fingers. This was a kind of 24, 48 hour sort of media scandal where it was breaking in real time over the internet, but probably the most high profile case we've seen yet. I know you've been tracking the data and kind of looking into these stories, but this isn't a unique phenomenon. It seems to be from your data set that this is that Bitcoiners or people who are publicly in Bitcoin are targets at this point, and that this is happening more frequently.
The only thing better than stacking sats is staking them. With Core's self-custodial Bitcoin staking, you can earn yield on your BTC without ever giving up custody, no new trust assumptions, no counterparties, and no slashing risk. Steal your keys, steal your coins, now your yield. Here's how it works. Lock your Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network. Help elect a Core validator and start earning Core rewards, passively, securely, and without risk to your principal. And with dual staking, you can boost rewards by staking Core tokens alongside your Bitcoin. Institutions can also tap into Bitcoin at scale with top custodians. Don't let your Bitcoin sit idle. Put it to work. Visit stake.core.dao/blockworks to start staking today. For the past decade, Ledger has been the global leader in digital asset security, trusted to secure more than 20% of the world's crypto assets. Celebrating 10 years of innovation, Ledger is making digital ownership more secure and accessible with their latest products, Ledger Stacks and Ledger Flex. These wallets feature the world's first secure touchscreens, simplifying your digital transactions while ensuring uncompromising security through Ledger's secure chip and proprietary OS. Plus, with the Ledger Security Key app, you can say goodbye to traditional passwords and step up your digital protection. Ready to protect your assets? Choose the most trusted name in hardware wallets, Ledger, and take control of your digital security today at ledger.com. If you've been around Bitcoin for long enough, you've heard the term HODL and the name LEDN. LEDN has been the go-to specialist in Bitcoin lending for over 6 years. LEDN helps you unlock the liquidity of your BTC, allowing you to HODL while still accessing the wealth of your Bitcoin. LEDN has been battle-tested with a focus on transparency, security, and trust. This has allowed them to build a proven track record of client success and security, helping tens of thousands of clients harness the value of their digital assets with confidence and peace of mind. Learn for yourself why so many clients trust LEDN by checking out LEDN's Trustpilot or their reviews on social media. And to learn more about what your Bitcoin can do for you, check out LEDN.io.
We recently surpassed the 200 attack mark. And to be clear, that's the attacks that we know about. And I suspect that this is actually a minority of the total attacks. Like, I suspect the majority of these events that happen, the victim doesn't go public with them. They do everything that they can to, you know, keep it out of the media, and in some cases maybe even keep it away from law enforcement, because they're afraid that if they go to law enforcement, then the media might pick up on it. So the short version of all of this is that there's a rough correlation with the exchange rate. The exchange rate is basically a signal, I think, for global adoption and an understanding of Bitcoin. And so as the global understanding of Bitcoin continues to expand, then of course that means that some small criminally minded element of people who start to learn about it are going to be looking at it from their perspective of, you know, I have this skill set. I know how to perform these types of attacks. Is it potentially a much higher return on investment and lower risk to me if I am targeting, you know, people who are likely to have access to a lot of this newfangled digital bearer asset? Because of course it is, it's giving you a lot of like the benefits of gold with much better transportability, and the ability to, you know, essentially instantaneously transport millions, if not tens of millions of dollars worth of value without having to have a physical burden associated with it.
Do you get a sense that the Ledger attack was a wake-up call, that it was unique? Is it just this captured the attention just because of just the nature of how it unfolded? Like, what do you think that event, you know, why do you think that event was so notable and captured that attention in ways others didn't?
I mean, I think it was notable because Ledger is one of the biggest and most well-known companies in this space. It was not unique in the sense that it's not the first time that, you know, an executive or someone high up, like a founder of a crypto company has been attacked. It was only, I think, a few months earlier when we saw the CEO of WonderFi get kidnapped from the parking garage at his office in Toronto, and, you know, essentially got thrown in a van and got the same type of deal where basically they ransomed him to get something like $1 million payoff from the company itself. So, you know, this is the same type of thing, except I think they asked for like $10 million from one of the executives at Ledger. And, you know, thankfully Ledger had the wherewithal and the connections to basically assemble a team of people to deal with this threat during that 48-hour period. And they were able to get a pretty good conclusion from it, where, you know, both the victims were returned mostly unharmed, and they were able to actually freeze and get most of the ransom money back.
Well, when I'm bringing in the multi-sig component, obviously Casa, myself a customer, you know, you're helping people secure Bitcoin with the technology to its fullest, kind of securing it in multiple jurisdictions, maybe with multiple different passwords, kind of, you know, using Bitcoin to the maximum sovereign extent. Do we get a sense that, like, with these attacks, that, like, people are more or less vulnerable with different types of setups? I mean, obviously, you know, there's a scale where, you know, people might have just cell phone wallets and, you know, a single hardware wallet or something like a multi-sig. Do we know that, like, one of these is particular, or they're, you know, more effective, or do these attacks, are they so bad that, you know, maybe people are forced to kind of fork over coins, even in situations where, you know, like we saw with the German government, where, you know, they were able to arrest somebody, and even though they had a hardware wallet with a private key maybe protecting it, they simply, you know, were kind of forced to hand things over. I guess, like, how do you think about these threat setups and how effective they are in the wild, actually?
Well, I think the biggest misconception or mistake that I see people making is they're conflating two very different security problems. On one hand, you have the security problem of, you know, how secure are your keys, or how secure essentially is your wallet and your coins and, you know, whatever is required in order to spend those funds. On the other hand, you have the security issue of, you know, your physical body. And so obviously the problem here is that your physical body is always going to be a single point of failure. You know, it's always possible for some bad actor to penetrate whatever physical security mechanisms you have and essentially take you hostage, you know, put you under duress. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that you can do, obviously, to mitigate and prevent those type of attacks. And I have tons of recommendations and writings that I have published regarding that. But if we understand that your body is always going to be a potential single point of failure, then the only way to truly secure your assets is to ensure that you are not a single point of failure for your assets. So you have to imagine the situation where you can be forced to jump through any and all authentication hoops that you have set up, you know, all of the digital and physical security mechanisms that you have for your keys. So that means, you know, the only way to ensure that your assets themselves can't just be taken under threat of force is if you yourself don't have direct immediate access to them. And that's where multisig comes into play. You know, multisig in and of itself is not a panacea. It really depends on the details of how you set it up. And preferably, you want to inject as much diversity into your setup as possible. You want your keys to physically be dispersed far and wide and be behind different sets of physical and digital security mechanisms. And you want it to take time. A lot of the you know, security prevention mechanisms, especially when it comes to physical attack stuff, is basically forcing slowdowns so that, you know, if an attacker wants to get through various security mechanisms and protocols, it actually requires waiting a long period of time. And the reason for this is a major disincentive to attackers, especially physical attackers, because they want to get in and out as quickly as possible. They don't want to be holding someone hostage for a really long period of time. The longer they're holding someone hostage, the more likely it is that law enforcement is going to track them down and find them, and it's not going to end well for the attackers. And you know, that's what happened in the Ledger situation. So, the short version to all of this is that it's very context specific. There's a lot of decisions that go into it. But it's certainly possible to have a setup that is wrench attack proof. So, you know, we're happy to, you know, help people understand exactly how you put yourself into that situation. But I don't want people to get too comfortable or have this idea that having a sufficiently distributed multisig setup will somehow prevent you from getting physically attacked. And the reason for that is that, you know, your attackers don't necessarily know your specific setup. And even if you broadcast it to the world, they may not believe you. This is the same reason why I don't recommend relying upon a duress wallet as a wrench attack mitigation mechanism, because we just don't know what would happen if you give some token offering to an attacker. You don't know if that will appease them and make them go away, or if they have enough information where they're expecting, you know, order of magnitude more money, you might just piss them off and make things worse. We don't have enough data points of some of these specific decisions that can happen inside of a wrench attack scenario. The only one that we really know related to that is there was one attack a few years ago where a trader got home invaded and tied up, and they were essentially torturing him, and he immediately handed over his full wallet, but they didn't believe that that was everything. They thought that he was giving up a, you know, token duress wallet offering. And so they kept torturing him for several hours until they were finally satisfied that he actually had given everything over.
Wow. Bleak stuff. And of course, not everybody, you know, with their own security, like Jack Dorsey, where I imagine he's traveling around. But so where are you at with your setup? Obviously, you know, you got Casa, you're securing your own Bitcoin. You have famously disappeared from the internet or removed your personal information. The New York Times article, you know, about you, I think from 2019, was that, you know, you had gone to the maximum extent. Like, what are you trying to perfect, like, in your personal setup at this point? Is it just the physical body? Like, you're trying to, you know, figure out the Taekwondo or like how to do that, or like where can you improve like your setup?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's a number of like physical security improvements that I would like to implement at my residences, but I'm in just such a different tier, I think, than 99.9% of people, where I've already put in a lot of the work and spent a ton of resources ensuring that the actual homes where I spend time are not tied to my identity in any way whatsoever. And so, you know, that gives me this whole other security layer, which is really the privacy layer. But you know, that's the important thing with all of this, is that, you know, privacy is an important aspect of security. So, you know, security is basically all of the mechanisms and multiple layers of authentication that you have in place to stop or slow down an attacker who is attacking you. But if you push it out logically even further than that, it's like, well, I would prefer not to get attacked in the first place. And how do you do that? Well, you make sure that you're not a target. And how do you make sure you're not a target? You don't give anybody a target to attack. So you don't give them an address to go to then surveil and figure out what the physical security is like. I mean, there are several cases with these Wrench attacks where the attackers were somewhat well-organized gangs of multiple people, and they would spend, you know, weeks surveilling the target, understanding, you know, when they come and when they go. And that's the really tricky thing. If you're living a fairly normal life, you're not just like living in a bunker 24/7, even if you have a highly physically secure, you know, fortified physical residence, you're probably going to leave at some point in time. And so what are you going to do then? Like, are you going to have an armored car with multiple bodyguards? You know, that's out of reach for the vast majority of people. But if you're being surveilled by a Wrench attacker, they're going to try to figure out your patterns. They're going to try to figure out, you know, where in your normal daily activities is the weakest point where there's almost no security. And that's when they're going to go after you and try to kidnap you.
Well, obviously, you know, the newer rebuttal to some of this stuff is, you know, maybe to take a page out of the Larry Fink or Michael Saylor playbook, which, you know, Michael Saylor holding, you know, most of his Bitcoin, it seems, at Coinbase. And in the case of, you know, the Bitcoin ETFs, you can have a lot of exposure to Bitcoin without holding Bitcoin at all. So how do you kind of combat the claim to people who are saying, you know, I don't want to think about the Wrench attack? Maybe the best way is to just give it to Larry Fink and the folks over at BlackRock, and you know, you can go raid the BlackRock offices in New York and take my ETF shares if you want my Bitcoin. I think there was the case a few weeks ago where the you know, popular influencer Plan B, you know, said that he has everything in ETFs, and people were sort of saying, hey, this is a smart way to prevent a personal attack. So your thoughts on that?
Well, once again, I don't think that that's going to prevent anything. You're assuming that people are going to believe you in the first place. So yes, if you take all of your Bitcoin and you put it into an ETF that doesn't even have the ability to withdraw it, then that has accomplished the goal of eliminating your physical body as a single point of failure for, you know, transferring all of your assets. And you've done that by adding in a single point of failure by giving all of your money to a trusted third party. What could go wrong? We only have about 15 years of history of what could go wrong. So, you know, you're giving up some of the fundamental properties of Bitcoin, and like the reason why this entire system was invented in the first place, simply because you're afraid of this one particular edge case attack risk. So, yes, I mean, it's an option. But once again, I don't think it'll necessarily prevent you from being targeted, because, as I said, you know, the security of your assets and the security of your physical body are two very different problems.
Well, you got me thinking about that decoy wallet right now. I don't know if I didn't know this was a thing. And now, you know, I'm weighing the trade offs here. So
there's a lot of things that could go wrong, though. I think I have a whole blog post about why I think it's a bad idea. And there's just a lot of things that could go wrong, and a lot of reasons why your decoy wallet may not be sufficiently appealing to the attacker. It may not look like a real wallet. Like, if you're not putting in a lot of effort to regularly maintain it and access it. And then, of course, you're also assuming that in this high duress scenario, that it's very hard to do a practice run where you have, you know, all the endorphins, adrenaline, other stuff, you know, rushing through your system. You might forget how to access that duress wallet. You know, there's just so many different things that could go wrong. It's why I don't really recommend relying on it.
Well, winding down the pod here, want to end it, transition into a segment. We're going to do a rapid fire kind of end question. So I'm going to ask a series of questions. We'll get about 20-30 seconds to answer them. Keep it kind of fun, wind down a little bit. First question, what was you ask Satoshi Nakamoto if you were to meet them?
I would ask when they left, what were the other things that they had moved on to?
That's a good one. What's the best thing President Donald Trump has done for Bitcoin since he was elected?
Starting to chip away at all of the government apparatus that were holding us back and persecuting us for so many years.
What's the most incorrect thing about Bitcoin that most people you meet still believe?
That it's anonymous.
That one has lingered for a long time, huh? What's the most embarrassing thing that you have ever done with your Bitcoin?
I mean, we've all spent Bitcoin on stupid stuff, right? I definitely spent some on a 30-year bucket of shelf-stable freeze-dried food, like multiple Bitcoin on one bucket of food.
Have you tried any of the freeze-dried food, or how is it?
No, I still have it. It's got a 30-year shelf. So, you know, I'm sure I'll look at it 20 years from now. And every time I do so, it'll really make my head hurt when I think about like how many like millions of dollars I spent on it.
Well, hey, if you ever really need that, it might there might be an equilibrium moment there. Okay, what's the best book or resource for understanding Bitcoin that you read or recommend?
My favorite Bitcoin book at the moment would have to be Broken Money by Lynn Alden.
That one's getting pretty popular. Why is that?
It's because it's not just about Bitcoin. It's about, you know, the first half of the book is basically about the entire monetary system, and then it transitions into Bitcoin and how Bitcoin fixes a lot of the problems that the first half of the book talks about.
If Bitcoin didn't exist, what other asset would you be bullish on?
I would pretty much be all in on tech stocks. You know, before Bitcoin, I was into things like Netflix back in the early day, like in the 2000s. And so, you know, I probably would have been into Nvidia and Amazon and such.
If you could orange pill anyone in the world, who would it be?
That is a tough one. You know, I've given up on orange pilling people so long ago.
There are some big targets out there, you know, Tim Cook, maybe Kanye, though he's coming around, I guess, with his own calling.
Yeah, you know, I hate going after celebrities these days because I think it's a slippery slope. I mean, if I could orange pill someone, I mean, it would probably be some of those friends and family who have not believed me for so long. And you know, the main reason is that I think that they'll be a lot better off if they get it.
Jack Dorsey is not Satoshi Nakamoto on lop.net or blog.lop.net. Jameson, where can people read more about your stuff?
Well, still on X at Lop and on Noster at an NPub that I couldn't possibly remember off the top of my head. Or as you said, lop.net, bitcoin.page also gets you to the same place.
Amazing. All right. Well, Jameson, thanks for joining us. This has been the Supply Shock Podcast. We'll see you at the Digital Asset Summit later this March. I'll be bringing a Bitcoin flavor to the crypto conversation there. Jameson, until next time, keep disproving the Satoshis out there. Appreciate it.
It'll do.